Okay, let's start. Welcome to Wombat Radio. Today we're talking with Bravo Child. Do you want to do your own little bio?
Sure.
The elevator pitch of who?
Yeah, the elevator pitch. You got 20, so like we've already three floors up. We've only got five floors to go.
I guess I like to whittle it down to being a writer, a game developer, and an experience artist, or maybe even game designer. There's so many different titles within the world of games.
Yeah.
Essentially, I love play. Mm-hmm. I love taking ideas through from purely an intangible concept through to something we can understand in the form of an art object, whether it be a picture or an object such as a toy or a costume or something like that, and then taking those tangible things and having them connect with the audience as an experience. Yo.
I don't know. I was just going to say when it was cool.
Oh, yeah, you got time?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right, cool.
So, yeah, I'll make it going. I've got to go pretty much at five, so.
Yeah, cool.
Do you want to go now?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Because that'll take like 2 minutes.
Come back.
Cool. I'm so busy.
Good
so busy and successful, yeah. We just got interrupted by more work. Just got to render something out for a client, no big deal.
We'll pause. And pause. And we're back from pause.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say... set a 20-minute timer.
Nice. All right, so I'll start that again. So basically, this is self-intro number two. We're in the elevator going down now.
Mm-hmm.
So Bravo Child, I guess I would try and summarize myself in an elevator pitch as being a writer, a game designer, and an experience artist, trying to take concepts, whether it be poems or stories, through art, translated in pixels or costumes or toys or whatever the case may be, and then finally arriving at the audience in the form of an experience. Because I think in this world, which is so inundated with cerebral information, understandings, pre-assumed knowledge, that a visceral experience through the senses is so much more innate and immediate.
And usually the topic of all of the Wombat Radio discussions have just been, what are you busy with?
Cool. Yeah, always so many so many things. I'm very good at starting things, so I get so many new projects underway. I'm not great at continuing things through to a conclusion. So busy with many things, I guess in summary it would be Cognitonaut, explorer of ideas, which I'm trying to put forward as a studio that takes care of those sort of things. So writing and concepts I'm trying to do in one day. Another day I'm trying to do the digital part, which I work in tandem with a business partner, Raz, on, and we call our little digital startup Penguin Wolf. So that mainly entails doing websites, apps, and games for people. And then Beautiful Frankenstein is the other tangible part where I'm trying to design costumes and toys, teaming up with a few costume designers and people who are good at crafty things to try and do that. And the final part is Watermelon Fireworks, which is the experience part, which is a number of faces, one being me on the street, kind of like a busking or performance art sense, a little cart giving people experiences, which is only at the planning stage. Also doing sensory workshops with people. I did one when I was over in New York recently, a couple months ago, which I think went pretty well. And I've been doing some practice with some friends, doing little sensory experiences for them, which usually just entails being in a room with a variety of you know, smelly things, crunchy things, tactile things, blindfolding them, giving them different experiences, or and also working with expectations. So in the workshop I did in New York, it was sort of setting people up, anticipating one certain sensory stimulus and giving them another and sort of breaking it down afterwards. And the other thing I'm putting my time towards is superhero school. So I'm calling this thing Phasm, which is Post-Human Academy for superheroes, aliens, mutants, and other wonderlings. And it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek or fun look at, you know, being causative in your life and achieving your goals. But at the same time, not ruling out the possibility of actually pushing evolution forward. So it's like, oh, what would happen if, you know, once a week you got together with people and tried to read each other's minds or tried telekinesis or any of these kind of things? It could be martial arts or it could be physical fitness or it could be focused meditation, whatever it is. It's peer-to-peer learning, so people can come with their own techniques. And we're just trying to say yes and be foolhardy and say, what if, you know? And at the very worst that would happen, we'll get a bit, you know, more fit our balance will increase, our accuracy will increase, and we'll set some life goals.
So that's your week filled if you do one day per entity.
Yeah, so what I wanted to do as well was live very openly and transparently. I love the idea of community, love the idea of open source, peer-to-peer learning. And so I literally published my schedule online, and anyone that wants to align at any of those stages is welcome to do so. It entails sort of waking up in the morning, doing Plai Chi in the park, which is something that my partner and I just made up. It's sort of like Tai Chi, I guess, but no real forms, just physically moving, with interacting with your environment, then doing some personal study, so whatever you want to sort of learn. Then there's a few hours in the middle of the day where I wanted to locate my studio as a mobile public installation. So I'm literally sitting there working, but people can come up and interact with me. And then doing workshops in the afternoon. So if you're interested in one of those things, the digital, the concepts, the tangible, experiential, they'll actually run workshops in the evening to push forward your own skills in that. So it's very much a full week. Friday I'm leaving free for performance art or doing some sort of social activation. Saturday for events, and Sunday is more of a community-based thing where we have superhero school, then we have a community lunch, and then just an open jam workshop.
There's a quote, and I'll find out who said it, but it's something like, find the thing that you love and then let it kill you.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you think you've found about 20 things that you love and you're just not letting go of any of them?
Yeah, I
and
think
that, and it like that is a beautiful way to be completely exhausted and exalted through life.
Definitely. I think, you know, you can get very emptied, I guess, in that exhaustion, but at the same time you're refilled very quickly as well. And I think having that change up between focuses allows it to be a continuous stream without it tiring too quickly, because the focus is always sort of changing. And also very many contexts. So right now we're sitting in the Penguin Wolf office, and then some days I'll be out in the park doing the superhero workshop, some days I'll be at home, also working with Alpha Mama on events and things like that. So it doesn't feel too repetitive. So it's constant, but ever changing.
There's someone, a fellow artist that I know from Norway, and she was talking to me recently about how amazing you are when you begin, and then how shit you are once you're past the beginner stage, but you're still learning before you get to mastery.
Yeah.
And if you can always stay in that just beginning stage, then actually everyone's like, wow, you're really good at that. Considering that's the first time you picked up just a guitar.
I think there's something about the having no expectations. It allows you to have that foolhardy, brave approach, because you know that people are expecting you to fall. If you fall, that's you've met the expectation. If you don't fall, you're amazing.
Uh-huh.
So you're sort of brave enough. And then I think you start to become a little bit precious when you're meant to, or you should actually know what you're doing by now and prove yourself, sort of thing. Similar, I was hanging out with a dancer friend recently, and I was surprised at how rarely he danced, because we were just making around, or I might be in the park waiting at a bus stop. I'll start to just dance at the actual club to music, dancing, whatever. And I'm not really a dancer. I love movement. And so I'll dance whenever, but I'm not expected to be good at it because I've got my strengths in other areas. I'm known for other things. But here he was a choreographer and paid professional dancer. And so it is true, if he was to move, I go, oh, cool, what are you going to do? You know? And so it was funny to see how little he actually did what he was so good at, because there was expectation.
Mm. And then I wonder about the idea of enlightenment through monotony.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder about that. And I wonder how different I would structure my time if I wasn't living in Sydney.
Sure, yeah. I guess there's certain social contexts. Don't necessarily demand it, but it's implied certain things, whether it be work hours, whether it be the location. I mean, even the fact that I come to this location, it suits expectations better, because clients come and they come to an established business, there's a room set aside, etc., which then totally changes my lifestyle, changes my travel pattern, all that sort of thing. But yeah, at the end of the day, I think when you get beyond the startup stage, you stop trying to please people to prove yourself, mm-hmm. and you're confident in your products, and then you can delineate what actually is most effective. And I think we're starting to get to that stage with our digital startup. We've actually been around for about a year now, and we're getting a team that I think is more confident with working with each other. And we actually had a consultation from a managerial person today who works on productivity and efficiency. And I really got the idea of how you can control the first few interactions with a client to say, let's really break down what you're going to deliver. Don't try and please them at every turn, but know yourself well enough and have enough confidence to say, we're not going to do that this round. This first deliverable will be this, this, and this, but we will get it to you on time. And then you get the, you know, the team satisfaction and the morale boost of, yeah, we completed something, and not have it all buzzing around with these incompletes, you know?
Yeah.
And in that case, if you're that confident, you could say, no, I work on my laptop in a park every day. But, you know, at the end of this month, you're going to have a fully, you know, refurbished website, you're going to have this app, and no one's going to question it. You know, you can walk around in boardies all day, but you're not trying to prove yourself anymore.
Yeah. Oh, I had this question just totally escaped my mind. So I wonder, and I've been wondering this, so about the dance, and then people become dance professionals, and then they stop dancing, and then they become like the representative of a group. They become the dancer of that group,
mm-hmm.
and then the other people watch that person dance. Just like sports players, that not everyone who's in a stadium going to see a match plays the sport.
Mm-hmm.
They've somehow outsourced the act of involvement in the sport and have become a spectator.
Mm-hmm.
And I have that. Well, I was thinking about this recently when I was talking to Jimmy about Pixel Meet Space,
mm-hmm.
and I was wondering how much we, or I specifically, like, took away the audience's ability to do the thing, and how much I forced them to be a spectator because I wanted to do the thing,
yeah, right.
whatever that is, and whether that's like making a toy and then giving it to the person to play with, they no longer can make it because you've made it for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think something like Lego is in the real sweet spot between that.
Mm.
Until Lego comes with instructions and you need different packs to make different things. But when they're more universal. But I just wonder about, like, is it our innate desire to play that has us playing with things so that we can then wrap them up neatly into a product then to give to somebody else, but a lot of the play is taken out by that. Not taken out, but by the time, I wonder if an item or an object or an experience that does ask you to engage and play with it, I wonder if that is always going to be in friction with a product.
Mm.
And that if somebody's paying for it, they want a certain amount done.
I think so. Like, talking about, well, the perfect word there is product, because product infers that there is a production unit that has produced a product.
Yeah.
And then in order to make that existence of that production unit viable, there needs to be a consumption of the product. So it's very much like the positive and negative, where peer-to-peer playing, contributors, participants, is not so much a completion of that cycle because there's an equal feeding in and taking. And so it doesn't actually allow the completion of the system that we have currently in place, which requires a consumer. It requires a completion. You play a different role to me. You're not here to play. You're here just to eat what I create, came through. You're here to consume what I produce through my playing. So no, I would definitely would say that is possible. And yet, due to the change in our interaction with media, which comes from the television's dead days of the one-way flow stream of radio, TV being I'm now broadcasting to you, you consume, through to the paradigm of things like Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, whatever it is, where we now want to contribute and we want it to be a little bit more peer-to-peer. I think that is shifting, and we're finding new economic structures and new things like subscribership and that sort of thing, that which now has a value. So on YouTube, if you've got a lot of subscribers, you have that leverage to now make the advertising money or whatever it is. Or games like Minecraft, which really are the digital equivalent to Lego, where you can build with these bare blocks your own world, your own trapdoors, your own great machines or buildings and that sort of thing. And that builds a great community because people feel there's some ownership or some participation. So I think, yeah, in one case, you're right. In our old system of thinking, it does take a lot of the play out because we require you to be the consumer to fulfill the cycle. But now, with our change of interaction, there's less value in that and there's more pull from something which gives us the toys to contribute and feel like we are buying into through our own play. And I think that's more and more valuable today.
And do you think that this, like the ultimate difference between, say, someone who logs into Minecraft and builds some stuff and they are playing on a level field with everybody else who's playing, and the product is a platform for them to play in, do you think the difference between those people and the people that are coding and designing their play environment is really they're doing the same things, but the only thing separating them is interest or level of skill?
I think it's almost like a reward system. I think one of the key addictive things about games is that there's an inbuilt artificial reward system. I mean, it can be something as simple in Minecraft if you're digging, that little that little sound is like, I just busted through another block and there's a little thing waiting for me. And of course those rewards happen naturally from the development end, but it's not handed to you in as sensory a manner. There's no special little dling, or there's no tally of your points, that sort of thing. You just have to find the reward yourself. And so totally, making a game and playing a game both have that play element and skills involved, you're right. There's a certain level of skill and understanding, and to be perfectly honest, I actually enjoy making games more than playing now. Although sometimes there's some amazing, you know, ingenious narratives and gameplay mechanics which are really fascinating. But yeah, totally right. They both can have that same play element. But I do think the other is more easy because of the reward, the inbuilt reward system. Yeah.
And, well, the only game that's really hooked me recently was, it's an iOS game called Monument Valley. And it's all the, like, mathematical mind-twisting of the old M.C. Escher drawings of the staircases that suddenly become other ways.
Yeah,
I'm not quite sure how. But you are a small girl and you walk around and you hear her footsteps, and there's, and so you think something won't line up so that you can continue walking, but then it does, and there's a little, it's like a dopamine hit of realization.
The best games are the ones that make you feel like a genius.
Yes.
for doing exactly what was the designer planned to happen.
I also wonder about how, say if we split the week up into one day per focus on something, and then I imagine that those days then are all interchangeable in the fact that something may run its course. It's not like a week block or a year block. That day, that thing that you do on that day may run its entire course of interest or of social relevance, and then that day becomes free again, and then you can find another thing and insert it into that. But I wonder when something has run its course and when it's obvious. Like, is it beyond the point of it being play, or is it beyond the point of challenge, or is it beyond the point of usefulness to others? I don't know the answer myself.
Yeah, no, I don't know. And I think it's a really good
it's like it's based in the fact that everything we're talking about is about initiative. Actually, you're not responding to anybody else's will.
Although I suppose in true play, I think there needs to be that cause and effect, because if it's purely on your own initiative, you're driving, you're authoring, you're putting forward certain elements. But the real play comes when it rebounds off another person or another thing, and you have to respond. I think that's where the true play and freedom comes from. And it's like if you are a child and you meet someone in the playground, you might sort of point at the swings and run over there, but they run to the slide. And it's at that moment where you either, well, I'm just going to swing anyway, or you go with that second offer. and you find yourself that's curious and that's exploring, that's the unknown. So I think that's definitely a key part of the play element, is having that other intention mm-hmm. or that other trajectory mm-hmm. intercept with your own.
And how do you know when something's run its course of interest?
Yeah, that's right. So you're talking about the yardsticks of whether the interest is there, the creativity, or fulfilled the social function and that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's so many that run out at different stages, and sometimes you just are pulling on two pistons and you expect that like you'll get all four firing again.
Well, it's a good question. I think I was looking at different economies, and this is all theory. I don't claim to be an economist by any means, but it was looking at the idea of production. Originally sort of a more agriculture based economy was based around a particular produce or a product, and then it got to the point of mass production where it became commodities. So it's more about how many units you could shift and where you could distribute them from. And then we got to the point where that was so predictable and reliable. There may have been some intermediate steps, but I remember there being a jump to experiences really being the main thing we were willing to exchange funds for. So that's where you get companies like Red Balloon, that sort of thing, which would take you up in a balloon or go whitewater rafting or whatever it is. But now there's even a push further beyond that to looking at the change that was on from the experience. So if you just have this experience and then you go back to work the next day and everything's normal, you go, well, was it really valuable? You know, at one stage it may have been, but now we're looking at how these things will change me. I want to go away to a meditation intensive, or I want to go do a class that teaches me how to massage, because I know that after that, my life is different. I have a new skill. I can interact with people differently. My understanding of life is different. So it feels like it's that change world around the world. So I think it's the resultant change that now has really become valuable. And so I think it's a really good question to ask yourself as a producer of anything, or just a human being that wants to engage as a contributing member of society. What is the change I want to bring about? And so in that case, if it's purely the social function, then because I want, after I do my work, people think of themselves differently or interact differently, that's the measuring stick if I'm done. Or if you think, well, I'm an artist, I'm a creator, the change I want to bring about is that people see my ideas and then think differently and are inspired to do other things themselves, or even just collect my work, whatever the changes that you want to bring about. Once that particular route has run its course, perhaps the other measuring sticks are irrelevant, because you're no longer serving your particular purpose for that endeavor.
And I remember last week finding out about the concept distinction between something having use value and something having exchange value.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it sounds like something that I'm getting from what you're saying is that maybe 20 years ago you would take up an apprenticeship that had exchange value, meaning you could exchange the skills that you're getting for cash, whereas the new experience economy, not being just a drop in the ocean, means that people want use value from the skills that they pick up. They go to an Italian cooking class or something,
they're
not doing it so that they can exchange that skill for remuneration. They're doing it so that they can use that skill.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really nice way of thinking about
what the opposite your time to any kind of capitalizing on markets or even the merchant system.
Mm-hmm.
Like, merchants don't buy things that they want; they buy the things that they can sell.
Yeah.
It's like I have such a flickback friction between use value and exchange value, and I know that exchange value is what Sydney really see, and like the prices of things in Sydney are based on exchange value.
Totally, as opposed to
competition.
Yep.
As opposed to use value, like what is the inherent value of this thing?
Absolutely. What will it bring to your life? Yeah, I think it's such a good way to have to reassess how useful something is, especially when you take the money out of the equation. The thing that brought that to my mind was recently when I was traveling through the States. I went from New York to Los Angeles and eliminated money from the equation. So I said, I'm not using a dollar. I left New York, literally walked out of the metropolis with not a single dollar in my wallet, and said, I'm not going to engage with money until I get to Los Angeles. I'm going to trade art as currency. So it, whether it be giving a poem for some lunch, or I made a website for a guy for accommodation, or I did some workshops and did a window installation for a flight. And then when people external to that wanted things from me, I had another friend back home saying, oh, you're doing this no money thing, but can you make me a website? Oh, now what can I exchange with you? And so it was no longer the exchange value or usual units. He thought, what can I do for you that you find valuable? And then he actually said to me, oh, I need to go and get some more skills, some things that are actually useful. But like, maybe I should learn, you know, become an electrician or learn some skills. I can come and fix your plumbing or this or that, you know. So what's actually useful started to become important when you take the dependable unit of money out of that exchange. This is cool. And I think relationships are a bit like that as well, where, you know, if you, because you're not going to be trading money with partners, but instead, what can I bring to this relationship? How can, when you meet up with me, what else can I add to your life? Can I take you on experience? Can I help you? Can we learn to ride bikes together? Or can the massage thing's a good thing as a partner? Oh, lie down, I'll give you a massage. You know, these are all functional, experiential, and useful things that will change you. And I think more and more with seeing as that as being the complete person, as opposed to I've got a job and society gives me a pat on the back because I made it, or I have a house. It's nice. I think as a kid looking at, you know, becoming a secret agent and, oh, I'd be able to read code and do martial arts and fly a helicopter, you know? It's a nice little package of rounding yourself as a human being by actually having, yeah, useful skills.
That's 25 minutes.
Great.
Should we just wrap it?
Yeah.
Hey, bravo. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for talking, Wombat.